From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When the director Peter Bratt signed on to make a film about the labor and social justice activist Dolores Huerta, he knew he could be telling a heroic story of how Dolores managed to organize farm workers in California in the 1960s, all while trying to raise 11 children and deal with the gender bias of the time. But Bratt insisted on presenting Dolores as a fully fleshed human being, which meant talking about the toll her activism took on her children and her family. Dolores herself has said you cannot make change unless you're willing to give something up. Today in the program, we're continuing our documentary series. We're going to be screening the film. It's called Dolores, next week. Today in the program, Peter Bratt is joining us to talk about it. After the news.
We want to take a moment to shout out The Good Line for supporting this podcast. If you're building a brand, these guys can help you with websites, film, design. They're all about finding and telling stories that bring together a full brand experience. Check out the new Radio West Films website to find out what that means, or you can see what else they do at thegoodline.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a moment in Peter Bratt's documentary about the labor activist Dolores Huerta where she's deciding whether to leave her home in Stockton, California, and go about 200 miles south to Delano, California, to help organize Latino farm workers. This is in the early 1960s, and the workers there faced deplorable conditions with little or no benefits, no options for negotiating something better. Now, Dolores was passionate about this cause, but she also happened to be the mother of 7 kids at the time, going through a divorce. And she says in the film, life in Stockton was comfortable. She had a home, she had friends and family. And many of them wondered why she would leave all of that to go help people who had nothing. Dolores explains that she saw her work then and now as a calling. So she went all in. Went to live in Delano, and alongside Cesar Chavez. She co-founded the first farm workers union and became a fixture, really, in the struggle for the rights of Latinos. Today in the program, we're continuing our documentary series. Peter Bratt is joining us to talk about his film called Dolores, which we'll be screening next week. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. Peter Bratt directed, wrote, and produced the film. He's joining us today from the studios of Jefferson Public Radio in Ashland, Oregon. And Peter Bratt, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to begin with, I guess, this question. When did you first meet Dolores?
Wow. I first met Dolores when I was a child, back in the early 70s. My mother is also an activist. She was involved with the farm workers movement and then also with the American Indian movement. And so we were at events where Cesar and Dolores would be present, speaking, organizing. And so as a child, I was around the, you know, leaders like Dolores and Cesar who from our eyes, you know, were like folk heroes. Yeah. Didn't pay much attention. We were too busy having a good time. But but then I later developed a relationship with Dolores in my adult years when my last film actually was about to be released in Arizona, and there was a big protest going on about SB 1070, which allowed police officers to pull over anyone who looked like or who they suspected of being undocumented, yeah. Yeah. Which a lot of people called racial profiling. And there was a boycott, and our film was about to open, and we didn't want to cross the picket line, so I called Dolores for counsel. And she said, no, you need to take this film in. Our people need something to lift themselves up right now. Hmm. And in fact, not only are you taking it, but I'm going to go with you.
Right.
and she accompanied my brother Benjamin and I, and we opened the film. And we've been in contact, you know, ever since that time.
One of the things you've talked about is that you've said that the Latino population there in Arizona, this was in 2009 at that time, was really nervous and they were looking for reassurance. And you've talked about the kind of influence that Dolores had when she was talking to people at that time when she went there with you, and that you were amazed by it. What were you seeing in her interactions with those people?
I mean, first of all, you're talking about an octarian. So at that time, she must have been in her late 70s. And, you know, she's a great grandmother, and she drove in all night, and she, you know, she was so energized. She had organized a meeting with some of the Latin Congress people, supervisors, community leaders, civic leaders, organizers, and really kind of brought this awareness to the premiere of the film. And then she led Q&As with Benjamin and I. And when we turned it over to her, she just fired up the audience and started, you know, addressing some of the issues raised in the film, but then also encouraging them to go out and organize and not be discouraged by what was happening politically around them, that there was an opportunity at hand and they had to seize it. And so the audience just got fired up, and we just kind of stepped back. You know, here's this like 78-year-old woman just on fire still, yeah. You know, after 6 decades of doing this work, just still so impassioned.
So let's fast forward to, I think it was 2014, when Carlos Santana gives you a call.
Right.
What did he say to you? What was he looking for?
We met Carlos when our last film, La Misión, came out. And so he was a fan, and we had met a few times. We did a screening for he and his family. And I always have to brag about this, but he gave Benjamin and I electric guitars, man, you know, autographed with his, you know, signature. And so we had talked about wanting to do a collaboration and not really finding or settling on a project. And then, you know, I got this call from him in 2014 or 2000, whenever it was. And he said, we have to tell this story about Dolores while she's still with us. And at that time, Dolores was 82.
Wow.
And so he put a stake in the ground and said, you know, I'll fund it. Let's get it done.
It's interesting. You said that when he said that to you, that for a while you felt a little panicked because you didn't really know anything about making documentary films.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't made a documentary before, and so I was a little nervous about that. And then I think I was also just feeling challenged by, you know, I didn't want to do, you know, the History Channel, and not to just the History Channel, because they do some really incredible work, but I was just afraid of telling a very dry academic documentary about work that had gone on, you know, 6 decades ago. Would anybody watch it? And particularly, would the new generation, would young people watch it? Mm-hmm. And so I really felt challenged to try to find a way to tell the story that was relevant to what was going on today.
You know, what's interesting about it is, and I think this is admirable, that you insisted that it, and I'll quote you here, that you wanted to present Dolores as a fully fleshed human being, warts and all, which says something, because you had a kind of connection to her. You knew her personally. You had, I mean, in some ways you had this, she was the daughter of a single mother. Your son of a single mother marched along with Dolores in the 70s, your mother did, and so you had this personal connection, and that you were willing to even look at some of the faults of Dolores, I think, is interesting.
Well, I think when anyone meets Dolores or hears Dolores speak, she really speaks without filters.
Yeah.
And she can easily look within, and when she makes a mistake, I made a mistake.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think sometimes when you look at iconic figures and you do films on them, they're so lionized that they're perfect beings, and I think what makes Dolores so accessible to people is that they can often see themselves in her.
Yeah,
you know, she her struggles, what she struggles with, she vocalizes it. She doesn't keep it within, and so I think people can relate to that. And so we really wanted to that part of her personality to really come out in the film.
It's interesting. This seems like a kind of a theme in some ways in the film. One of the distinctive aspects of this movement was how Dolores and others believed in embedding themselves in these communities. You know, not coming from the outside to help them, but being part of these communities,
right.
And I want to play a moment from the film because this is expressed in the film by her kids, which she, of course, enlisted in the cause. The idea of them not being apart from it. They were part of it.
Right.
So here's a moment from the film. We'll hear from Juana Chavez, her daughter, Emilio Huerta, her son, Ricardo Chavez, and Dolores herself from the film, Dolores.
My uncle, Cesar Chavez, and my mother were both greatly influenced by the philosophies of Gandhi. You can't help people unless you live like them. So we're not going to be able to help organize farm workers unless we live like the farm workers.
My mother and Cesar ingrained themselves in the community, and they lived in those communities. They didn't fly in from Washington or San Francisco or L.A. to say, you know, we know it all, and we're going to teach you guys how to build a union. They said, we need to build an association that addresses the day-to-day needs of folks.
I only knew growing up that when we were poor, because we were, my mom would always tell us, you're poor by choice.
We have a tendency to want to be too comfortable, you know? And I'm trying to educate my children in the way that I'm raising them to give their lives to work for other people. And I'm hoping that out of the, you know, 11 that I've got, I sure ought to come out with a pretty good percentage.
We didn't get it at the time, the lessons that she was trying to teach us. And in fact, we were, like most teenagers, rebellious and angry about her ideas of materialism. Our biggest dream was just to be like the kids at school who had all the latest fashions. But we didn't get any of that stuff.
So we knew we were outside of the norm for sure.
Where do you think, Peter, where did that come from, that sense of hers, her commitment to embedding yourself in the lives of these people that you're going to help? Do you have an idea about that?
Yeah, I mean, she spoke earlier that her and Cesar both were heavily influenced by Gandhi. Yeah. And certainly that was one of Gandhi's points when he was organizing. You know, he took a vow of poverty. He lived like a lot of the people he was trying to liberate. And so, to live simply, even when he took up weaving, mm-hmm. you know, the fasting, and he really wanted to live like the people, like his countrymen, you know? And so I think they started down that road, you know, influenced by Gandhi. But I think Dolores and her kids will tell you, you know, that when she came to the planet, she came with the program.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think you can look at her upbringing and all the influences, but I think when you get down to it, like her children, I believe she came with a mission. Like you mentioned earlier, it was a calling.
Yeah.
You know, she couldn't deny it. And even to this day, I mean, the film opens, she's staying in some, you know, Days Inn, cheap hotel, mm-hmm. going to, mm-hmm. she'll ride an eight-hour Greyhound bus ride to go do something at a state prison, and then get on a bus and take, you know, go crash on someone's living room floor or couch. And she still lives that way. I mean, Dolores could have made a ton of money. She could to this day still do that, but she keeps it very basic and simple, and the work is at the forefront.
There's this question that you've asked in your writing about the film. And that is, why is it that people, I mean, there's been a ton written about Cesar Chavez, but not that much about Dolores, even though they worked alongside, they were co-founders mm-hmm. of that first, you know, farm workers union. And one of the questions you ask is, why is that? Like, why do we hear, is it just because he's a man, she's a woman? And then the question is also, was her story, Dolores' story, as you've put it, just lost accidentally or left out deliberately? Now, tell me what you think about that.
I really think it's all the above. I mean, I consider myself a fairly, you know, well-informed person. And like I said, I knew Dolores. I knew of her work. I had a great, you know, deal of admiration and respect for her. But when I came to the project, I had no idea that she was a co-founder.
Yeah.
I thought the farm workers movement and union struggle was really a singular vision of Cesar Chavez. And I came to that with that assumption. And then, as you mentioned, when I started reading all the books, you know, she was never mentioned. So that actually became part of the narrative. You know, why is that? I think it has to do with her being a woman of color. And then, as she says in the film, you know, she was a female raised in the 40s and 50s, and she had this ingrained sensibility to accommodate men.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's one story she says, you know, she negotiated the very first farm worker contract in history, in U.S. history.
Yeah.
And when the photographers and press came in to do an interview and take the what's now an iconic photo, she was seated at the table with the other attorney, and a fellow farm worker, a male farm worker, came and said, you know, can I have your seat? And she said, oh, yeah, go ahead, take my seat. But she talks about how that was part of how women were conditioned, you know, to accommodate, you know, male authority. And she was doing that, I think, throughout a lot of her career, and it really wasn't until her feminist consciousness was awakened in the later 60s and early 70s that she really made a conscious decision to change that.
I want to play another moment from the film, because this in terms of the difference that she made, her attitude difference, and even comparing it to Chavez's attitude, I think kind of comes out here at this moment in the film. So they basically had to go out on their own. The community service organization that they had been involved with early on didn't want to help them organize this union. So they, as you explain in the film, they had to go out on their own. And so no longer did they have the support of, you know, these white activists in the same way. And so they were going to go out on their own. And Dolores talks—
And they didn't have the money or the infrastructure.
Exactly. And there's this moment where this is Dolores in this moment from the film talking about this conversation she's having with Cesar Chavez.
That's when Cesar had called me to come over to his house, and he said, we have to organize a union. But he put it this way, he said, unless you and I do it, it's never going to happen. And then he said in the next breath, but we will not see a national union in our lifetime because the growers are too rich, they're too powerful, and they're too racist.
Now, there are two things that I took from that. One is how daunting it would have been to create that thing. But Chavez didn't think it would happen in their lifetimes. Mm-hmm. She did. I think her attitude was completely different. She had, it seemed to me, I have to say, more of a sense of possibility maybe than others. Maybe that was part of her gift, it seemed.
I think that the two of them together created an alchemy. And she did. She had that energy. I mean, she still does to this day.
Yeah.
It never wanes. It's always forward. It's always positive. It's always, you know, like the saying she coined, yes, we can. Si se puede.
Yeah.
And I think Cesar brought another energy, and those two together created a magic that really pushed it forward and inspired people.
That's Peter Bratt. He directed, wrote, and produced the film Dolores, which we're going to be screening next Wednesday night. That's March 14th at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. This is part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Peter Bratt will be there. So will Dolores Huerta for a Q&A after the film. So you should come. We have details about it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Dolores Huerta, who co-founded the first farmer workers union in the 1960s, right alongside Cesar Chavez. The filmmaker Peter Bratt has made a documentary about Dolores's life, and today in the program, we're talking about it because, know it or not, she's one of the most important social activists in American history. There's this theme in the film I wanted to ask you about. Let's talk about the conditions for migrant workers at the time. What was it like in those early 1960s for farm workers in Southern California, for example?
Well, I mean, 40s, 50s, 60s, and even I would say today. I mean, you don't have the child, you have child labor protections now, but, you know, back then you would see school kids, 6-year-olds, 8-year-olds, younger, you know, out in the fields, picking in 115-degree heat, working sun up to sundown. Oftentimes, farm workers lived on the farms in these shacks that growers provided, and they would take it out of their salary. Those shacks didn't have running water, didn't have electricity oftentimes. They were made out of cardboard, you know, pallets. They would be extremely cold in the winter and in the evenings. Farm workers would oftentimes be in the fields, and they would be sprayed, coated with toxic pesticides, and many of them died. Yeah. A lot of children were born with birth defects. They didn't because a lot of them were brought in as braceros. They were guest workers. They couldn't organize. They couldn't vote. A lot of them didn't speak English. And so they were essentially a powerless class.
Yeah.
I think it was Luis Valdez in the film who says, you know, it was another form of slavery. And that model, that structure is still in place today. And I think it's like Cesar told Dolores, you know, the growers are too powerful. You know, there's racism that's embedded within the structure of agribusiness.
Yeah.
And there's a reason why growers don't want farm labor to have the ability to organize.
Let me play that moment from Luis Valdez. He's this playwright and remarkable filmmaker. He created the Chicano Theater, and he talks about that contradiction in the U.S. And it's kind of a theme early on in your film about how slavery comes up against the ideal, you know, of freedom in America. Here's another moment from the film Dolores.
One of the really tragic contradictions about the United States of America is that it has presented itself before the world as a beacon of independence and liberty and human rights. Of course, the real stain on this mythology is slavery, and with it, the potential for the enslavement of others. This was a very real threat for all Mexicans living in California after 1848. It was a continuing threat for all of the immigrants that came from China, Japan, the Philippines, Vietnam. Racism has been endemic to American history. The feudal wage slavery of agribusiness is really just an extension of the attitude that has persisted in the country. And the irony is that none of us can live without food. None of us can live without what's produced in our fields. This is life. And yet, these are the worst paid workers on the planet.
I guess that idea of slavery, it's kind of, it's kind of a theme in this sort of part of the film, and it's expressed by various people in the film, this idea that it was a sense of slavery. Mm-hmm. And, you know, where are you supposed to go? And it's even interesting, too. Eliseo Medina talks about how one of the worst parts is, you know, they talked about Mexicans as being built closer to the ground.
Right.
Like they were a different species or something like that. They were
born to work in the fields.
Right, right. And that he said that was almost the worst part because you were held in such contempt by mm-hmm. those people.
Yeah. I mean, Dolores often says that, you know, when you're out picking in the fields in the Central Valley, you could be miles from a town. You're out in the middle of nowhere. It's 115 degrees. There's no toilets. There's no drinking water. You have to go to the bathroom. You go right there in the field. Somebody holds up a towel or a shirt, and that's your bathroom. And Dolores often says that those conditions were deliberate. You know, they were put up by the growers as a deliberate way to dehumanize and create a powerless class. You know,
it's interesting the film that you have from those times, and you really get a sense in just the body language of some of those, some of those corporate leaders or teamsters, and just the sense of hostility, I have to say, really comes through in the film.
Yeah. I mean, I can't help, as we were digging through the archive, certainly when we started the film, Barack Obama was the president. we couldn't foresee the political climate today. And now watching the film, you know, I just sat through the film the other day with an audience. Just the parallels of what's happening, you know, the rancor that's going on, you know, in national conversation around immigration, you know, around gun control. Just so much of the sentiment that you talk about identifying in the film, I see it today, and in some ways, you know, we've moved forward as a culture, but in other ways, we haven't moved at all.
I want to ask about that decision that I mentioned in the introduction, where Dolores has to decide whether she's going to leave the kind of the comfort of her home, although mm-hmm. I'm sure it was never terribly comfortable in some way. She was always on the go, but to go to Delano. And she says that she knew she had to go and do something.
Right.
But it would mean leaving that established life. Would you talk a little bit about that? Because as I said, the circumstance of her time, and this is one of the themes in the film too, is she had a bunch of kids. I mean, she had seven kids at that time. Eventually she had 11 kids.
Right.
Going through a divorce, and people just near her thought she was crazy for leaving.
Yeah, they still think she's crazy.
Yeah.
She probably is a little crazy, because I think you got to be a little bit of crazy to want to make the change on the level that she does. I mean, I really do put her up there with other iconic figures of the 20th century, like Gandhi, like King, like Malcolm, Fannie Lou Hamer. I mean, I think you have to be a little bit outside of rational thinking, because it's oftentimes what she did is not rational. Her children like to say she went from this is not a rags to riches story. It's a riches to rags.
Right.
She was college educated. She was a teacher. She had made a middle class salary, and she did. She felt a calling, and she gave it up. Similar to Gandhi again. Mm-hmm. You know, he was an attorney. He could have done well for himself, but he did give it all up, and he dedicated himself to this struggle. And I think Dolores did the same thing, and I think she'll literally go until she drops, till she can't do it anymore. And it goes back to what she said. It was a calling. You know, she came here with that mission. I think in her early years, you know, she talks about being a Girl Scout.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to be a professional dancer. That was her passion. And then she saw these conditions, and once she saw, it's kind of like the blue pill in the Matrix, you know, once you take the pill and you see the illusion, you know, you pull the curtain back, she couldn't go back, you know, and she did. She gave up everything to pursue that.
Let's talk about the effect it has on our kids, because that's one of the things you explore in the film. Let me play another moment here. We'll hear from Emilio, her son, and Juana Chavez, her daughter, and Lori de Leon, another one of her daughters. It's great that the kids really were involved in the film, I have to say. There are a lot of them, and a lot of them were willing to talk to you about how they felt about all of this.
Yeah.
Here's another moment.
She was always gone. It wasn't a 9-to-5 job. She was, you know, gone before we got up. We'd have to get ourselves ready to go to school and try to find something to eat.
Well, my mom's absences had some positives and negatives. I dropped out of high school. My mom didn't find out till 10 months later, you know, so. We were spending the night in people's homes that we didn't know. We were going to labor camps and not knowing if somebody was going to shoot at us, as they did many times. It was very hard. I'll be honest with you, tough.
The movement became her most important child. I realized the importance of the work, but I was also very jealous of it. So there's scars there, you know, there's scars there because of that.
When she was around, we were just like soaking in as much as we could of her, because we just knew she was going to be gone again.
You know, Peter, you get the sense in the film that even though the kids have come to terms with that sacrifice being a necessary part of her activism, mm-hmm. they still struggle with it, it seems.
Yeah, they did. And you know, Dolores and they too will readily admit that sometimes they still are dealing with it. Sometimes they still struggle with it. You know, as these kinds of issues, I think, are prevalent in every family, you know, mm-hmm. and we're constantly working it out as families go. But I think what makes Dolores such a fascinating, you know, subject, such a fascinating and captivating American is this fact that she did willingly give everything up, sacrificing even the comfort of her children to create this change. And even she mentions, you know, that there's a great law of life that if you want to affect real and lasting change, you have to sacrifice something. You know, nothing comes for free. You have to sacrifice something. And I think that's a great reminder today when you see a lot of young movement builders, organizers, who oftentimes think, you know, we can create this change overnight. But if you look at Dolores and others like her, they play the long game. And oftentimes these changes, they take decades, sometimes lifetimes. But what they require more than anything else is some kind of a personal sacrifice. You have to give something up to create change.
Here's another moment from the film. This is Dolores.
This might sound kind of corny, but you have to really love people, you know, to want to teach them, to want to help them grow. Because you're giving a lot of yourself when you're doing that. It's not just filling out the form and filling out the paper. When a farm worker comes in with his problem and then you're going to start telling him the history of his abuse and start getting him angry, that's going to take something out of you right there, you know?
That really struck me, that moment in the film. She realized the costs. I mean, she loved music. She loved dancing. She wanted to maybe spend more time with her kids, mm-hmm. but something, because she had met those people, transformed her, and she couldn't really do anything other than that in some ways.
Yeah. And I also think that her and Cesar both realized that. I mean, they were joined by volunteers, organizers from around the country, and some of them became well-known in their own right, other organizers. And I think that when they would train young people, they would tell them that this is going to take something out of you. You know, yeah. And that footage that you just cited, she's leading a training for young organizers, and they're telling them this is going to happen, and so you need to find a way to keep yourself charged, keep yourself healthy, because those are the things that come with the job description.
Another, I have to say, kind of disgusting tactic that was used against Dolores was questioning her moral choices, that she was just running around with men, having all of these kids that her, you know, she had gone through two marriages, one relationship, had a child out of wedlock. And if you think about it, putting it in the context of the time, you know, the 1960s, right. that really was used as a tactic against her, it seems.
Yeah, I mean, I think growers realized her power and Cesar's power. You know, that she was on the FBI list, mm-hmm. you know, as a danger, as a threat, as a national threat. So I think, as a strategic point, they threw everything at her to try to take her down, and that certainly was one of their tactics, was to dress her down for being an improper woman, for having children out of wedlock. For not being, like you said, she had some children with her last companion, Richard Chavez, who she never married. You know, they criticized her for that. I think that seeing a powerful woman like that just was so threatening and so challenging for the times. I mean, you have to. We're living, it's what, 2018 right now. We're talking about the late 50s, the early 60s. Yeah. You know, on television you had Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best.
Right.
So you're talking about someone who's just really bucking the cultural traditions. And then also within the you know, the Mexican-American community, that was also, you know, she was not a quote-unquote good Catholic. She was a Catholic. Yeah. But she had children out of wedlock. She did divorce. And I think that was shocking to a lot of people. So it was definitely used as a tactic to try to dress her down.
Another one of the things that the film really conveys was just the sheer energy and excitement of the time. So much going on. You know, the environmental movement is catching hold. The feminist movement is catching hold. Of course, civil rights. I think Malloy Martinez, one of the farm workers you show in the film, talks about there being this kind of electricity.
That's right.
In the air. I mean, it was an amazing time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a question that just came up naturally, and I think it was also Angela Davis who talked about how when the Black Civil Rights Movement was going on and the farm workers movement was also happening and the birth of the feminist movement, that these leaders, they were connected. They actually knew one another and they supported one another. And that there's a lot of talk today about intersectional activism, but as Angela pointed out, they were actually living it.
Yeah.
And so you had people, members of the Black Panther Party, coming down to Delano bringing food and even money to help support the effort. So there was this cross-cultural coalition support that was happening, and I think it was electrifying, as Eloy points out. And then the other thing, too, which was really fascinating, people had tried to unionize farm labor in the past. It, you know, people had attempted for over 200 years, and everybody failed. Mm-hmm. So here, you know, you talked about Dolores and Caesar. They left the CSO. You know, there's no infrastructure. They have no money. They just have sheer willpower. Yeah. And they moved down to Delano. What made them think that they could do it? And I think it was that they were on the cusp. You know, there was this electricity in the air, and people really, as Angela so eloquently points out, people really believed that revolutionary change was possible.
Yeah, and I think the thing that was so profound about this moment, and we'll hear from Luis Valdez and Angela Davis in this moment, was how, as he puts it, it was about self-love.
Right.
The idea that once you can become proud of who you are, that's when you can start enacting a kind of change. We'll hear from Dolores also in this moment. Here's another moment from the film, Dolores.
Revolution starts with self-love, in the sense that if you're a member of an oppressed people, an oppressed class, you have to develop self-respect. And that starts by developing some affection for who you are. You love your family, and you say, okay, but why does the world regard them as inferior? Why does the world regard them as ugly, when in my eyes, they're quite beautiful?
Movements not only affect laws, they also affect the way people feel. They affect emotions.
Well, then, is this more a social movement?
It's both. You can't separate it. It's both a labor movement and a social movement. Or you can say it another way. I think all of the labor movement has also been a social movement.
I never thought of it in that way. I mean, she doesn't disconnect them. She thinks they're together, this labor movement and a social movement. And in that sense, it's something that Dolores talks about. In many ways, this was a real cultural revolution going on.
Cultural, and I think in her work and her life example, you literally see how all the issues and the movements connect. I mean, here her and Caesar, they started off with what essentially was a labor struggle, and then as they get into the trenches, they realize that a lot of the barriers they have to do with race. So it was also a struggle for racial justice. And then, you know, as farm workers are dying in the fields because they're literally getting coated with these toxic pesticides, by addressing that, you start seeing, you know, they launched what essentially became the environmental justice movement. So it also became an environmental justice struggle. And then you see Dolores being marginalized both within the farm worker movement and the dominant culture because she's a woman. So you really see... Yeah. You really see, you know, through her life example and her work, how all of them intersect and then interweave with one another, and how they really are all connected.
Well, and then the environmental community really had to learn this lesson from the farm workers. This is a point that's mentioned. Gloria Steinem is one who talks about this, is that this was a real blind spot for the environmental community. I mean, they were focusing on species and land, but they had kind of forgotten the human element. And this is something that Chavez and Huerta had to bring to that to that environmental movement.
Yeah, I think it was Gloria said, you know, the environmental movement was focused on the trees. They were focused on the redwoods, not the people. Love that line.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, let's play it. It's a great moment from, again, from the film. And by the way, we'll also hear in this film Randy Shaw. He's an organizer.
Right.
In the 1960s, labor was seen as anti-environmental. Well, here's the farm workers in the vanguard. They won. They got DDT banned. They founded the whole idea of environmental justice.
Older environmental groups often were concerned with the redwoods. They were concerned with the trees, not the people. It was Dolores, among others, who made this linkage by making people look at the human cost.
The environmental justice movement said that certain environmental hazards are disproportionately impacted on people of color. That would never be allowed if these people were white middle class. So it wasn't simply stopping DDT, but it was also making the larger point, you're only allowing this because of who the workers are and their race and class background.
Hmm. Yeah.
Think Flint, Michigan.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing that does come up, is you realize when you look at these issues, they're it seems like they're always connected to class and race.
Yeah. Yeah. And many of the conversations going on today, it's the same thing. You know, you're also talking about race and class. I mean, Standing Rock is a prime example of that. You know, originally the pipeline was supposed to go through another town, which was a white town, and there was protest, and they rerouted it. Let's run about Indians. You know what I mean? It's in many ways the same struggle.
That's Peter Bratt. His film is called Dolores, and we're going to be screening it next Wednesday night. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. It's going to be at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. Peter Bratt will join us for a Q&A after the film, but so will Dolores Huerta, so you should join us. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the filmmaker Peter Bratt. We're talking about his documentary film, Dolores, which we're screening next week. We'll give you details about that a little bit later in the program. There's a part of the film I wanted to ask you about. This is involves Dolores' relationship with Senator Robert Kennedy.
Mm.
Talk a little bit about Kennedy's involvement, because this seemed like there was such potential, something was going to happen.
Right.
To talk a little bit about this part of the story.
Well, first of all, just when we were doing the research, and we came to the realization that Dolores had literal connection or interaction, or was like one person removed from interaction with some of the greatest figures of the 20th century, you know, including Gandhi, King, Malcolm, Angela, RFK, and so we ended up calling Dolores, you know, the Forrest Gump of activists,
right.
You know, because she was there at these pivotal moments in American history, and connected to other large figures like almost like no one else, and one of those examples is in the film when she. You know, she's at the Ambassador Hotel standing shoulder to shoulder with RFK as he's giving his victory speech, and come to find that he was going to be assassinated minutes later. She was right behind him. And I think it impacted her in a really, really profound way. Certainly in the struggle in the field with the strikes, there was oftentimes violence and then, you know, resistance to violence, being nonviolent as a Gandhian tactic. Hearn Caesar employed that. But I think, as Eliseo mentions in the film, you know, here's Kennedy. He's gunned down right in front of her. You know, she's right there at that moment. And he was this, you know, he kind of reminded me of when Barack Obama was elected in 2008. You know, there was this sense that he was going to really bring in a whole new era.
Yeah.
You know, and he was going to usher in justice, and he was going to champion, you know, marginalized people. Like, he came out, you know, from the East Coast to stand with farm workers, you know, people who have nothing in Delano, California, and really help put their struggle on the map and in the national spotlight. And so there was this incredible promise that I think his presence brought. And then when he was gunned down, it just completely evaporated.
Well, I mean, there's this moment in the film. In fact, let me play this. Two activists, Rick Rivas and Curtis Acosta, talk about that sense of possibility mm-hmm. when Kennedy gets involved.
And to see this Harvard-educated guy from Massachusetts talking a funny accent stand with us, it meant something.
You can't imagine a political figure of that station these days going after corporations with that vigor. For who? Not for his own. Not even on his coast.
Wow, right? We have somebody of national prominence who knows who we are, and he's running for president, has a chance to win.
I mean, had a real chance to win.
He really did.
I mean, after he had won with Dolores right alongside, that's a great... I hadn't realized Dolores was standing right next to him. There,
right.
Of course,
and we've all seen that footage. But then,
yeah.
Oh, my God, that's Dolores.
Yeah, Kennedy, with Kennedy, the Ambassador Hotel. Yeah. And, of course, he's, as you say, he's killed, of course. And one of the things Gloria Steinem talks about is that it was kind of like there was the death of the future.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there was real momentum for Kennedy. It seemed like there was going to be progressive change. And then Richard Nixon is elected,
yeah.
You know, that year. And but it's interesting to talk a little bit about Dolores' reaction to that, because it seemed like she didn't seem to waste time with regret or mourning the things that could have been. That just seems contrary to her sensibility, I think.
I don't think there was time for that. I mean,
yeah.
you have to imagine that during that time, you know, there's a strike going on. And farm workers are struggling. Farm workers are dying.
Yeah.
You know, children are dying. And so there is an incredible urgency to not let up. And so even in the face of tragedy like Kennedy's death, I mean, it definitely impacted her. And I think, you know, it set the farm workers union back. But again, there's Dolores at the forefront saying, all right, let's mourn. But we got to pick ourselves up and we got to move forward, because that's what he would want.
Yeah. I have to say that I don't know what to make of the I don't want to give too much away in the story, although people can learn about it. But once Cesar Chavez dies, it's so obvious that she's going to be chosen as the one to replace him.
Right.
But it doesn't happen that way, and suddenly her input isn't as welcome. And this is maybe tragic is the wrong word, but this just seems sad in those last days of her, at least her experience with the union.
I mean, you know, with the current conversation that's happening right now around the Me Too and what women put up with and have put up with in every category. You know, it's not just in Hollywood, but in Washington, and I think even at the grassroots level in organizing movements, women put up with these barriers. And so in that sense, you know, like you said, obviously they have to hand the baton to Dolores.
yeah.
But then again, you know, like as she points out, it was a male-dominated executive board, and she wasn't chosen. So I think And this was, you know, this was in the 90s. This conversation is happening right now, and we're seeing mm-hmm. how widespread those barriers and that resistance to women's leadership and equality really is. And I think in the case of Dolores, it's not dissimilar.
What's she doing now? You would forgive her for slowing down a little bit, but she doesn't seem like she is.
Yo, brother, she has not slowed down, and I'm not lying. This is she turned 87 this year. Like I said, we started the film when she was 82. It was oftentimes hard to track Dolores down and get her to sit in front of the camera because, you know, the film was truthfully not that important to her. She, you yeah. know, she had work to do.
Yeah.
And she still organizes at the grassroots level. She's still in Central California. She still, like, goes door-to-door registering voters. She's out speaking to farm workers, to immigrants. She's Kern County in California is the largest school district in the country. They're fighting the school-to-prison pipeline. She lobbies at the state level in Sacramento. She lobbies at the national level. I mean, she is nonstop, and she shows no sign of slowing down even at 87.
Yeah. That's the filmmaker Peter Bratt. His film is called Dolores. We're going to be screening it next Wednesday night. It's part of our Through the Lens series on documentary film. This is our partnership with Utah Film Center. It's at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. We'll get underway at 7 o'clock. Peter's going to be with us, and of course, the great Dolores Huerta will also join us for a Q&A after the film. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Peter joined us today from the studios of Jefferson Public Radio in Ashland, Oregon. Peter, thank you very much for taking
the time. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we'll see you next week.
Great, man. It was a pleasure.
Thanks. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Claire Jones, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Philosophy, which holds one race superior.